The views and opinions expressed on America's Workforce Union podcast and its digital media channels are solely those of the speakers and do not necessarily represent the views and opinions of the producers or sponsors.
Welcome to the America's Workforce Radio podcast, the flagship production of the American Workers Radio and Podcast Network, where organized labor and its never-ending fight to protect the rights of the American worker come first. Now, presented by LIUNA, Laborers International Union of North America, here's your host, Ed Flash Ferens.
The continuing fight over the U.S. steel deal, what Nippon is pledging, what the Steelworkers Union is saying. Now Barnes & Noble workers want to go union. And today on the show, author Kim Kelly and the workers, the number of them, who went on strike in 2023. Welcome to the Monday, April 8th edition of America's Workforce, where we're available on at least five platforms, including Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, iHeartRadio, Spotify, and Pandora. We have two guests on the show today. We're going to start things off with Kim Kelly, no stranger to America's Workforce. She's been on before, especially when she came out with her book, Fight Like Hell, which is now in paperback. A little background on Kim. She's an independent journalist, author, organizer, regular labor columnist for Teen Vogue. She did a number of articles on the plight of women in nail salons. She's also written for The New Republic, Washington Post, New York Times, The Nation, Columbia Journalism Review. Video correspondent, she served as for More Perfect Union and The Real News Network with our friend Max Alvarez. Kim is a third-generation union member, member of the Industrial Workers of the World Freelance Journalists Union, as well as a member and elected councilperson for the Writers Guild of America East. Solid union background, and I'll tell you, she goes right into the belly of the beast. She did a lot of stories about the strikers, which is now over at Warrior Met in Alabama. I mentioned the nail salons, but her book, Fight Like Hell, if you get an opportunity to pick it up, do so. And it's all about the struggles of people over the last couple of centuries to make a difference, to make lives better for workers, whether they're in a union or not. So Kim is going to be our first guest. Johnny Callis will be joining us later in the show. And the last time we had him on, he was at Cornell doing some research. And he is now at the University of Illinois School of Labor and Employment Relations. He serves as an assistant professor there. He's also the project director of the Labor Action Tracker, which is a joint project between Cornell and Illinois. And the research focuses on strikes and labor militancy in the United States. Now, recently, the two schools announced the arrival of the Labor Action Tracker annual report. And that's what we're going to talk about on the show. This report found 470 work stoppages last year, and about 539,000 workers were involved in those work stoppages. Strike days, now this is monumental, 24,874,522 strike days in 2023. That's a significant number. Now, although that only represents a 9% increase in work stoppages from the year before, it does represent a 141% increase in workers involved. An increase, the report credits, to the number of high-profile strikes last year, including the UAW stand-up strike and the SAG-AFTRA strike. So Johnny Callis is going to run all the numbers down and get a glimpse of where we are this year. I mean, obviously, there's a lot more to go, but I'll tell you, he is one heck of a statistician, and he'll be joining us as our second guest right here on America's Workforce. Now, a brief look into the world of labor, this segment brought to you by Boyd Watterson Asset Management. You can find more at boydwatterson.com. The United Steelworkers is maintaining their opposition to a Japanese steelmaker's $14.1 billion acquisition of United States Steel Corporation. Recently, the union publicly dismissed a letter from Nippon as a, quote, meaningless piece of paper, despite its expressed commitments to job protection. Nippon had called the letter a binding commitment as it seeks to build support for the politically sensitive deal. USW leadership, headed by Dave McCall, rejected the company's characterization of the letter, saying, and this is a quote from Dave, "It is instead nothing more than another collection of empty promises and open-ended language that would enable it to skirt obligations to workers and retirees." Now, Nippon's new president has pledged to press ahead with a takeover, and this comes despite opposition from President Biden, who has said that U.S. Steel should be American-owned. The Japanese company and its U.S. arm, according to Nippon, are committed to take the steps necessary to establish a peaceful, cooperative, and productive relationship with the Steelworkers Union. So we'll see what happens here. We had a good conversation on Friday with Fred Redmond. Fred, now Secretary Treasurer of the AFL-CIO, longtime member of the Steelworkers Union. If you missed that, just go to awfpodcast.com. But I'll tell you, there's a lot of people going against this. An automotive industry trade group is calling on the White House to consider the implications of this deal. If the administration has concerns about the Nippon Steel deal, it must seriously consider alternative outcomes, wrote John Bozzella, president and CEO of the Alliance for Automotive Innovation. He says one option that should not be on the table is an arrangement that creates a market concentration of domestic steel production in a single company. Now, the Alliance for Automotive Innovation, their membership comprised the biggest names in the industry, including Ford, General Motors, Honda, Toyota, and Volvo, among some of the tech giants like Panasonic and Qualcomm. So a lot of people lining up and saying, not a good idea. Not a good idea if you go in that direction. Across the U.S., Barnes and Noble workers are preparing for a nationwide union drive. In the past year, six Barnes and Noble stores across the country have voted to unionize, and workers in other stores have followed suit with their own unionization campaigns. The workers in unionized stores have expressed concerns about lagging wages, safety problems, excessive job duties, among other workplace issues. Now, in response, listen to this. The CEO of Barnes & Noble, a guy by the name of James Daunt, is said to have visited different stores urging workers not to unionize. You don't want to do that. One worker in a New York City store recalled, "CEO Daunt's big argument against us unionizing was it would make his life harder," which he would repeat several times. He said it wasn't very successful. So that's a first. I've never heard this before. If you go union, you're going to make the CEO's life harder. You don't want to do that to the CEO. Now, would you? All right. We have to take a quick break. Kim Kelly, author of Fight Like Hell, coming up next on America's Workforce.
This is America's Workforce.
It takes LIUNA to build North America's infrastructure. From roads and bridges to schools and skyscrapers, the men and women of LIUNA, the Laborers International Union of North America, build the projects we depend on. From constructing the Freedom Tower on the site of the former World Trade Center to untangling Washington, D.C.'s congested interstate, LIUNA members do the work that matters. Find out what it takes to be built by LIUNA at LIUNA.org. That's LIUNA.org.
The Iron Workers Great Lakes District Council, consisting of 8 iron worker local unions in West Virginia, Pennsylvania, Ohio, and Michigan. We build the skylines and bridges along the Great Lakes. With more work than ever before, the Great Lakes District Council is actively searching out the next great iron worker. Whether it's building the next Intel plant or constructing a bridge to safely connect our great cities along the lake. So join the Iron Workers Great Lakes District Council today. Find out how and learn more about the council by visiting iwdistrictcouncil.com. America's Workforce is brought to you in part by the United Auto Workers. Find more at uaw.org.
This segment of America's Workforce is brought to you by Survey and Ballot Systems. SBS has been providing unions with secure and flexible election options for over 30 years. Visit surveyandballotsystems.com to learn more.
hire union musicians. Call Music Talent of Cleveland at 216-881-1802. Call Music Talent of Cleveland as your dependable source for professional musicians in Northeast Ohio. Union musicians add harmony to weddings, elegance to parties, and uplifting music for all events. Music Talent of Cleveland contracts solo and ensemble musicians as well as bands and orchestras for single engagements. So hire union musicians. Call Music Talent of Cleveland today. 216-881-1802. This portion of the show brought to you by the International Union of Bricklayers and Allied Craft Workers. For more information, please visit bacweb.org.
Hey, this is Sean McGarvey, and I'm president of North America's Building Trades Unions, and I'm a proud listener of America's Workforce. I love this podcast.
America's Workforce is brought to you in part by the International Federation of Professional and Technical Engineers. You could find more at ifpte.org.
America's Workforce Radio is sponsored in part by the International Union of Painters and Allied Trades, District Council 6, representing painters, glazers, drywall finishers, and sign and display industry workers. They remind you that belonging to a union is your right as an American.
This segment of the show is brought to you by the Brotherhood of Maintenance of Way Employees Division of the International Brotherhood of Teamsters. For more information, please visit bmwe.org.
Now, back to America's Workforce. Here's Ed Flash Ferens.
And don't forget, you can check us out on Facebook or follow us on X, formerly known as Twitter. That would be AWF Union Podcast. AWF Union Podcast. Everything is archived there. By the way, this next segment brought to you in part by the United Labor Agency, where you could find more at ulagency.org. Right now, let's go to line number one, and welcome back to the show. It's been a while. Kim Kelly is her name. She is an independent journalist, an author, and an organizer, and she's also been a regular labor columnist going back some years with Teen Vogue. She's written for, let's see, The New Republic, Washington Post, New York Times, The Nation, Columbia Journalism Review. She's also been on the Valley Labor Report. We've done a lot with them over the last couple of months with Adam Keller and Jacob Morrison. And Kim is here going to talk about her book. Her book was out for some time now, Fight Like Hell. With a title like that, it definitely gets attention. Kim Kelly, how are we doing today, my sister?
I am loving your radio voice. It's taking me back. Obviously, that's just you, but it's taking me back to my time doing college radio. I love it. This is great. I love the radio. It's great to be here.
Well, I started many, many years ago in college radio. It was the station was WCSU. They changed their call letter since then, and it's Cleveland State University. And then shortly thereafter, I found my way into rock radio and worked for a legendary station, WMMS, which was copied. It was what they call an AOR format, album-oriented rock. And I'll tell you, we broke a lot of music. It was a great time in my life. But I love what I'm doing now. Been doing the show. It'll be 26 years this July. And almost 4 years now podcasting. And with that being said, we got a lot of listeners. We're in the top 1% of all podcasts in the country. So why don't we, let's start with a little bit of your background. How you got involved in journalism, how you became an author. And I'll tell you, there's one thing about Kim Kelly. You go into the belly of the beast. You don't mess around. When you cover a story, you really get into it. And I saw what you did with the coal miners, especially at Warrior Met. So, Kim, talk to me about getting involved in this field, because this is a tough field. It really is. A lot of newspapers, radio stations have disappeared. News departments have disappeared, so it's important that we have good journalists out there. So talk to me about getting involved in this. Go ahead.
Yeah, I love that you mentioned that you come from the rock world, because so do I. I've spent most of my life prior to this labor thing as a heavy metal journalist. I've covered in tattoos. I never even thought I would end up doing anything but talking to metal people and hauling amplifiers all day. It was really only when I became involved in organizing at my old job at Vice, a struggling digital media company, and got to really experience organizing a union and bargaining and fighting and winning. That totally reoriented my approach towards my work. I was always interested in covering, you know, the lesser known stories, the more marginalized people, the things that have been pushed underground. in the music world. And now that I have this incredible opportunity to tell working people's stories and cover labor conflicts and do whatever I can to boost the cause of working class liberation, it's really, it's not that dissimilar, right? Like getting to know people, listening mm-hmm. to people, respecting people's opinions, trying to figure out where they're coming from, even if it's somewhere different from you. It's not that different from being a rock journalist. It's just maybe a little bit more impactful sometimes, I'll say. You know, rock and roll right. matters, but right. almost everyone has a job and everyone has an opinion about it, right? So I got involved in organizing, I started writing more about labor. I got my big break as a labor reporter, or a baby labor reporter, writing for Teen Vogue, writing for that mainstream audience. And I was able to make more connections and outside of the music press and start writing more about labor for other places. I've been doing a ton for In These Times. I'm working on something for The Baffler, for Rolling Stone. I'm kind of all over the place because, like you said, media is, it's not in a great spot. It hasn't been in a great spot. And I kind of like being a lone wolf, you know. I like picking what I'm going to go after and being freelance despite the downsides.
Yeah.
And I was lucky enough to get an opportunity to write a book a couple of years back that actually, it came out in 2022, but then the paperback came out last summer, so it still feels pretty fresh. I wrote a book called Fight Like Hell, The Untold History of American Labor. That is, I guess if Howard Zinn was a tattooed blonde lady from Jersey, that's the vibe. It's like a people's history, focusing on the stories that you're not necessarily going to see in the more mainstream tellings of our story. And I had a great time with it. I had a great time traveling around, talking to students and union siblings and folks all around the country about the book and about their experiences while I've been doing my reporting. And I've had a really good time. You know, being a labor reporter is tough, not a lot of money in it, but I feel like the most rewarding thing I could possibly do with my time. And I'm just so glad to be a part of this movement.
Well, I remember reading when you mentioned Teen Vogue, and I think that was the publication. Didn't you do something on nail salons, the people that work at nail salons?
Oh, yeah, I did. I think I've written a couple things about that, just about the working conditions that those workers, most of them are women. Many of them are immigrant women from Asia, South America, Latin America. Just like the horrific conditions that they're forced to work under. There's been some legislation, some movement in a couple states, but it's still just a very brutal workplace. And I wanted to find out more about it. And I thought it was important to cover that for a place like Teen Vogue, where there are a lot of folks that read that publication that probably get their nails done, you know? And I wanted to just give some food for thought for folks. Like, look, if you're going to, you know, engage with this industry, at the very least, make sure you're tipping a lot to help offset some of the downsides.
By the way, we're speaking with Kim Kelly. Kim is a freelance journalist and author of the book Fight Like Hell. We'll talk more about that book. She's also a third-generation union member of the Industrial Workers of the World Freelance Journalist Union, as well as a member and elected council person for the Writers Guild of America East. Now, that was one of the unions. We had a lot of work stoppages last year, and my union, SAG-AFTRA, was on strike. That was a different contract than the one that I work under. We had the Teamsters almost walked out. We had the UAW that did walk out, the stand-up strike. Did you do anything with the UAW last year? Because that was a really, really interesting kind of a different way of strikes. Sean Fain, kind of a rebel there, along with Sean O'Brien of the Teamsters. I mean, these are people that were very feisty in what they were able to accomplish. Did you cover any of that last year, Kim?
I followed it just because I was so interested. And I didn't get a chance to write much about it because I was traveling so much, doing book promo and working on my next book. And I kind of got sucked into doing other homework, you know? But there are a lot of other labor reporters that have done a really incredible job of following that. Alex Press, Luis at Labor Notes, he's done some great stuff. One of the nice things about being part of this community of labor reporters is that if one of us doesn't get to a story, someone will, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And Sean Fain is just, I've gotten to hear him speak several times. I got to have dinner with him and Sarah Nelson a little while ago. That guy's the real deal, you know. I think the UAW folks that elected him, they definitely have done a huge service for the entire working class by giving that guy the reins, because he's the kind of leadership I wish we had in more of our unions, honestly.
Yeah, they really took a lot of people by surprise, including the CEOs at the big three, because when they said that they were giving themselves 40% pay raises, Sean said, well, okay, we'll take a 40% pay raise. If it's good for you, it's going to be good for us. Yeah, good stuff. If you get an opportunity, you know, he testified recently on Capitol Hill, and that was Bernie Sanders' legislation to go for the 32-hour work week. And if you go to the UAW site, UAW.org, you can see Sean's testimony. Great guy, as well as Bernie, too, because they're saying all the right things. And hopefully, I mean, there was a time in America, you know this, you looked at labor history over the years. And, I mean, there were people working 70, 80 hours a week, and that was kind of the norm. And then we finally got to the 40-hour week, and now, hey, you know what, with all the technology today, let's go to 32 hours because productivity is up there. But a lot of CEOs just don't seem to get that. It's somehow they're missing it. And Sean Fain is definitely one to watch, especially down the line. So you were working on, now are you working on another book here? You said that you were pretty busy over the last year here.
Yeah, it hasn't been officially announced yet, but I'm working on a young readers edition of my book. So aimed at kids 10 to 14, breaking down a bunch of the concepts and themes in my book, Fight Like Hell, and focusing on biographies of a whole bunch of the labor leaders and rank-and-file workers that I profile in the book. I'm pretty excited about it.
Well, you should be. Kim Kelly joining us on our live line. Kim, can you stay? I want to talk more about Fight Like Hell. I want to talk about what's going on, especially in the coal mines. I know you've been doing a lot. Well, you were at Warrior Met when they were on strike, and they still haven't really resolved that. We had Cecil Roberts on the show earlier this year talking about that. There's a fighter. There is a true fighter there. But we'll continue the conversation right after this. You're listening to America's Workforce.
You're listening to America's Workforce with Ed Flash Ferens.
It takes LIUNA to power North America with affordable energy. The men and women of LIUNA, the Laborers International Union of North America, have the skills needed to build and maintain oil, natural gas, nuclear, solar, and wind projects that are shaping America's energy future. From new energy tech to retrofitted facilities, LIUNA members do it all. Find out what it takes to be powered by LIUNA at LIUNA.org. That's LIUNA.org.
Attention members of the Heat and Frost Insulators Union who are interested in traveling. Central Ohio has more construction projects on the books than anywhere in the U.S. Mega projects, large and medium-sized jobs are creating more work than our local 50 brothers and sisters can handle. Projects like Intel, the Honda LG battery plant, and multiple data centers for Facebook, Google, and Amazon offer union wages, overtime, and exciting incentives. Local 50 is seeking union travelers to meet the needs of its signatory contractors who can put you to work immediately. If you're a member in good standing and interested in the work opportunities in Central Ohio, visit insulators50.com/AWF travel for more information. America's Workforce is brought to you in part by the United Steelworkers. You can find more at usw.org.
Union members need to be heard. Reliable and convenient union voting has never been more important than it is now. Make voting easy for your membership by working with Survey and Ballot Systems. SBS offers encrypted and monitored solutions that ensure your elections are accurate and accessible for every member through mail-in, online, and in-person voting. Visit SurveyandBallotSystems.com and take the next step in getting secure and auditable elections.
This portion of the show is brought to you by Anthem Blue Cross and Blue Shield, labor's trusted health partner, bringing people, communities, and care together to transform the future of health. For more information, please visit anthem.com/labor and trust. America's Workforce is brought to you in part by the Ironworkers. You can find more at ironworkers.org.
America's Workforce is sponsored in part by Boyd Watterson Asset Management, LLC. Find out more about our investment solutions tailored to meet the needs of Taft-Hartley funds at BoydWaterson.com.
America's Workforce is brought to you in part by the International Brotherhood of Teamsters, where you could find more at teamster.org. America's Workforce is presented by the Laborers International Union of North America. Feel the power right now at liuna.org.
Now, back to Ed Flash Ferens with America's Workforce.
And remember, you can check us out on at least five platforms. That includes Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, iHeartRadio, Spotify, and Pandora. And when you get an opportunity, here's what you do. Just sign up and receive our shows on a regular basis and give us a rating. We always appreciate those five-star ratings, so please keep them coming. Let's go back to our live line and rejoin Kim Kelly, an independent journalist and author of the book Fight Like Hell, which came out a couple of years ago, 2 years ago. And you mentioned in the first segment it's now in a paperback that came out a couple of months ago. Did I hear that correctly?
Yes, that came out last summer. Yeah, it came out in paperback, and I'm thrilled about that just because it's a little bit more accessible, a little cheaper. We love to see that. And I fixed some of the typos. So if you're looking for a nice plain read or something to read on your break or on the bus, it's available wherever books are sold.
Well, if you don't mind, can you share some of the stories, one or two? I want people to buy your book, and we can lead people to where they can get it. But it would be important, I think, to kind of tease our audience right now. As I indicated before, got a lot of new listeners since you were last on the show, and they want to hear what those stories are all about. And that's kind of what we do here on America's Workforce. There's a lot of things the mainstream media, and you know this, Kim, they're ignoring those stories. It's so corporate today. It's important to know what's going on in America. So what can you share with us here on the show?
Well, it's like a 400-page book, so there's a lot in there. But since you guys are based in Ohio, I'll mention one of my favorite people in the book, and some folks might even be familiar with her because she was a local gal, a woman named Ida Mae Stull. Now, she wasn't a labor leader. She wasn't even a union. She was a worker. She was specifically a coal miner in the 1930s when that was not done. It was actually illegal for women to work in coal mines and other heavy industries at that point in time in the state. But she wasn't really interested in following that law. And she followed her family tradition into working in the coal mines and actually became a part owner of a mine. And she was having a great time until the law showed up, the government showed up and said, hey, you're not allowed to do this. We got to shut you down. And she went to court over it, and she won. And I think that is such a wonderful example of a person, a regular working person, standing up for themselves against someone who is telling them, oh, just because of who you are, your gender, your background, your identity, you can't do this job. And that's total BS. We know that's BS. But throughout history, mm-hmm. so many people have had to fight just for the right to work, the right or to work in a way that they want to. And I love talking about Ida Mae Stull because I'm trying really hard not to swear because we're on the radio. She was a tough gal, and labor history is full of tough gals, whether it's Maria Moreno, who also in the 1930s, she was a Latina and indigenous farm worker, a mother of 11 children, who helped organize what would become the United Farm Workers. Or folks like Ben Fletcher, who was a black dock worker here in Philadelphia, who helped organize a militantly anti-capitalist, interracial union on the docks here in 1910. People that don't, you know, they don't get as much attention as Cesar Chavez or Walter Reuther. Everyone deserves that much attention, you know? I got to write mm-hmm. about Lucy Parsons, a black woman in Chicago that helped organize a bunch of garment workers and led the first May Day parade in Chicago in 1886. All kinds of cool, radical people that either were not given the attention they deserved or weren't respected during their time or just kind of got buried under the dust of history. And, of mm-hmm. course, lots of brilliant academics and researchers have done so much work to preserve their stories, but I wanted to share them with folks in a way that was really accessible and fun to read and hopefully inspiring to show people that No matter who you are, where you come from, someone just like you has fought to change the world, and a heck of a lot of them have actually pulled it off.
Yeah, yeah. They want to make a better place for us all. Your research, I mean, where did you, this had to be, well, it had to be a labor of love, no pun intended here, but this had to be very intense and a lot of travel. Can you tell us what you went through to get this book done?
Well, gosh, I wish it had been a lot of travel, but I sat down to start writing this book in early 2020. So I had all sorts of plans to go and visit labor centers and archives. Well, that was the very beginning of the COVID pandemic, so I couldn't go anywhere.
Oh boy.
So that led to a whole different challenge of, okay, how can I get access to the things I need? And shout out to the Free Library of Philadelphia. The librarians helped me a ton with sourcing materials. And there were resources like JSTOR, like academic journals online. I actually have a bunch of friends in academia who helped send me journal articles and things that I couldn't access, because I'm not, you know, I don't have that .edu email address. I actually have a pretty solid labor history library myself, just because I'm a big nerd and I love this stuff. I was able to pull from a lot of my own collection. And then, of course, doing interviews with folks. There's a ton of interviews in the book with both historians and actual subjects and workers and organizers. And so I just was a little bit of a magpie, and I pulled it all together and sent it to my editor, 20,000 words longer than they wanted. It was like, all right, this is your problem now.
That's funny. And you still got a lot of pages, let's be honest. But 20,000, yeah, that is a low. There's no question about that. Let me ask you this, Kim. What about labor unions? Have you got it to various locals, maybe even the AFL-CIO? You know, it's so important, and I talk about this on the show. I mean, we have to know how we got here, you know? I mean, vacation time, the eight-hour day, health benefits. If it wasn't for the UAW, we wouldn't have employer-sided health care, which is, you know, being challenged in so many different ways. But it's important to get that message out, especially to young people. And I know you want to talk about that too. Are you connecting with the current generation, the young generation, on labor unions and the history of the struggle of the working class? Is that happening with you?
Yeah, honestly, I've been really lucky in that I've been asked to come speak at a lot of different universities and colleges across the country. So I've got to meet with tons of people. Like, I'm in my 30s, but meeting kids in their 20s and even teens who come out to these events, or I come to their classroom or I give a talk at their university. It's so much fun, and it's so illuminating to see how much the younger generation really cares and how hungry they are for knowledge and how interested they are in organizing their own workplaces or their own schools, right? Because there's a ton of organizing happening in academic world with adjuncts and researchers and RAs and all types of different job titles that exist at these universities and colleges. I think the younger generation is really connecting with this. I think so much of the enthusiasm we're seeing around labor right now is coming from younger people who are realizing, maybe even for the first time, oh, wow, like, things don't have to be like this. I'm on my first job or second job and things aren't going great, but I have options. I can organize. I can get involved in the labor movement. I can do something about this. I'm not powerless.
Mm-hmm.
And I just wish that I had known more about that when I was younger, because I probably would have had a much better time at some of my crappy jobs.
Well, I've said this so many times on the show. I mean, we do a horrible job, especially in the high schools, when it comes to labor history. And I remember when I was growing up, I was reading one history book, and they were showing the strike. It was a GM plant, like 1937, and the car was on fire. And I said, well, here's what unions do. They set cars on fire. I said, wait a minute. And I come from a steelworker family, so I grew up in a union environment. My dad was a longtime steel. I had two uncles in steel. I had two in Teamsters. So, I mean, I grew up in that environment. And sadly, there's a lot of people that have not. And I know you did as well. So it's important to know. You have to know the working class. You have to know the struggle. And you have to know the people behind the struggle. And that's what Fight Like Hell is all about. You know, we didn't even touch on the coal mines here. We just got a couple of minutes left. And I know you did a lot. What was it on black lung? And a lot of young coal miners are getting black lung today. I did talk to Cecil Roberts about that. So you were in, what was it, West Virginia? Is that right?
Yeah, I went down to West Virginia a couple of times to basically investigate what was or what is happening in Central Appalachia. Black lung, this horrible scourge that I think a lot of folks outside the region maybe think of as a historical thing, right? Like coal miners used to get black lung, but then we did some stuff when it got better. Well, some things did happen, like the Mine Safety Act of 1977, and especially just developments that happened in the 90s that really brought the levels down. But now it's gone back up, skyrocketed. It's really horrible to see that this horrific disease is impacting miners in their 30s and their 40s. They're breathing in so much silica dust in addition to the coal dust that's just tearing them up. And there are some moves being made. MSHA, the Mine Safety and Health Administration, is trying to push through a new regulation about silica that would make it safer in the mines. There are public safety programs that they're trying to get off the ground. But it's really just heartbreaking. And I got pulled into writing about it because I know a lot of coal miners, right? The past few years now, I've been covering a series of strikes and just other conflicts with coal miners in the Deep South. And I've gotten to know a lot of the UMWA folks, including Cecil and Chuck Nizel, who's the VP of District 2. And he was the one, he's around my age. He was telling me about how he has a hard time breathing now. And a lot of the guys he knows, even younger than us, are having a hard time breathing. And I decided I needed to dig into it, see what was going on. And it's not good. It's not those coal bosses are still as concerned with profit as opposed to people as they were back in the 1800s.
Yeah, yeah, very sad. I could throw the rail industry in on that too. I mean, it's brutal on a lot of the railroads right now, and it's just getting worse. I mean, I can't believe they got trains 4 miles long now. And they want one person to operate them. It's like, what? Are you kidding me? Kim, this has been a great conversation, and I'm glad we're talking about that, especially with the coal miners. We're coming up to Workers Memorial Day at the end of April, and we talk a whole lot about that here on America's Workforce. And the latest job, they're going to come up with new numbers, but the numbers from last year, 343 workers die each day from hazardous working conditions. That's almost 5,200 a year. And 120,000 die from occupational diseases like what you just talked about, black lung, because those deaths happen years later. And sadly, they're not actually accounted for when it comes to death on the job. And I know the AFL-CIO does a really good job on that report, which will be coming out shortly. I'm going to leave it on that note, Kim. It's been a pleasure. Once again, Kim Kelly, author of the book Fight Like Hell. Kim, what's the best advice you can give our listeners to get a copy of your book, which is now on paperback?
I mean, I'd always prefer if you buy it from a union store, but if not, just pick up one for yourself, your siblings, your daughter, your coworkers, and you can even send one to your boss just to see what they say.
There you go. Kim, you take care. Let's do this again down the road, okay, my sister?
That sounds great. Thank you so much.
All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, Johnny Callis of the University of Illinois School of Labor and Employment Relations. The number of work stoppages in 2023. That story coming up next.
This is America's Workforce. More shows available at awfradio.com.
It takes LIUNA to keep America running. Over 70,000 public employees are part of LIUNA, the Laborers International Union of North America, delivering critical services such as healthcare and emergency response, as well as maintaining roads and sanitation systems. Even the National Postal Mail Handlers Union, representing over 47,000 U.S. postal workers, is affiliated with LIUNA. Find out what it takes for LIUNA to keep America running at LIUNA.org. That's LIUNA.org.
Founded in 1887, the Brotherhood of Maintenance of Way Employees Division of the International Brotherhood of Teamsters represents the employees responsible for tirelessly constructing and maintaining the national rail system in America. For more than a century, the Brotherhood of Maintenance of Way Employees has proven they have what it takes to protect its members and meet the ever-changing challenges of the rail industry. Today, the BMWED continues to fight for job security, fair wages, better benefits, and safer, more modern work environments. For more information, please visit BMWE.org. America's Workforce is brought to you in part by the Heat and Frost Insulators Labor Management Cooperative Trust. Find out more at insulators.org/LMCT.
There is unity and strength for workers.
We are the USW.
We are the USW.
The United Steelworkers.
The largest industrial union in North America.
We represent 850,000 members in the U.S., Canada, and the Caribbean.
We work in metals,
rubber,
chemicals,
paper,
oil refining, atomic energy, and the service sector.
We are steelworkers, standing strong and fighting for what's right.
Are you looking for a new healthcare partner for your union members? Let Anthem Blue Cross and Blue Shield be your champion, making sure your members live their healthiest lives. Now more than ever, it's important to have a partner you can trust, one who understands the unique challenges unions face. Anthem provides a variety of options to meet your organization's needs and helps you control costs without sacrificing quality of care. For more information, visit anthem.com/labor and trust. America's Workforce is brought to you in part by the Communication Workers of America. You can find more at cwa-union.org.
Now, back to America's Workforce. Here's Ed Flash Ferens.
And don't forget, you can check us out on Facebook or follow us on X, formerly known as Twitter. That would be AWF Union Podcast. AWF Union Podcast. By the way, this next segment brought to you in part by the Ohio Federation of Teachers. You can find more at oh.aft.org. Let's go to line number two right now and join Johnny Callis. Johnny is now a assistant professor at the University School of Labor and Employment Relations. In fact, last time we had him on the show, he was working on his PhD at Cornell University, their School of Labor Relations, and he joined the Illinois group just recently here. So it sounds like you got a little promotion. You decided to move on. What's the story here, Johnny?
Great to be with you, Ed. Thanks again for having me on. Yep, I just joined in January at the School of Labor and Employment Relations at Illinois as an assistant professor, but I'm still leading the Labor Action Tracker project and trying to continue doing some important research. At least hopefully some people think so.
And I see that you were a union organizer, in fact, in the state of Ohio, Tennessee, and California. What got you involved in union organizing? Can we get into that first before we talk about what happened last year with all the strikes and work stoppages?
Yeah, absolutely. My grandparents were both union members. My grandfather worked in the post office until he passed at a relatively young age, and my grandmother was a teacher out on Long Island in the New York City area. And unions brought important economic security for my parents and in a lot of ways by extension to me. So I've always had an interest in the labor movement. I spent a year in Cleveland right out of college working on the Fight for 15 campaign as an organizer. Was a really transformative experience for me. So I've always had a deep passion for workers' rights, did that work as an organizer in the labor movement, and now hopefully I'm making somewhat of an impact as a researcher as well.
It's funny you mentioned the Fight for 15, because I remember when that started. It was in New York City, I want to say about maybe 12 years ago. And a lot of people are saying, what are you doing? This isn't going to happen. And here we are today. In fact, now we're fighting for $20 and $25. Got to throw inflation in there. But I get it. I certainly get it. Let's talk about this labor action tracker. Now, you are more or less, I guess, a statistician. You've been keeping a close watch on what's been going on with organized labor. Last year was incredible. Absolutely incredible. I know. Almost a million people, well over 900,000, got double-digit raises. Why? Because they said, enough is enough. We're going to go on strike, or we're going to threaten to go on strike. So talk to me about the numbers, Johnny. Go ahead.
Yeah, we noticed a considerable uptick both in the number of strikes, but especially in the number of workers on strike in 2023. So there were 470 work stoppages involving about 540,000 workers on strike last year. That's up from about 424 work stoppages involving 2,000 workers the year before. So quite a considerable uptick, especially in the number of workers on strike. And this was a range, right? These were largely driven by particularly large strikes in Hollywood, the stand-up strike by UAW members across the country, a three-day strike by Kaiser Permanente healthcare workers, but also included a lot of smaller strikes like those by Starbucks workers and fast food workers across the country as well. So definitely a considerable uptick. And I think, as you mentioned, what our data don't directly capture, but you just did, there were also a lot of very credible strike threats, most notably by the Teamsters at UPS. So certainly an important year for labor action. And now the question is, will that continue into 2024 as well? But I'm happy to talk more about our report if that'd be of interest for you last year.
Yeah, sure, sure. Let's get into some of the demands. And obviously pay is usually at the top of the list. Can you run down the different demands by unions, what happened last year? And I'm sure a lot of that is continuing this year.
Definitely. Our three most common demands, number one, far and away, as you said, was improved pay. But also, I think importantly, number two was health and safety improvements, and number three was better staffing. And I think this really reflects the issues that workers have been facing over the last few years as a result of the COVID-19 pandemic, as a result of ongoing inflationary issues, and as a result of just being underpaid. So pay, like I said, certainly was a top demand. But you have a lot of workers, especially in customer-facing industries, whether it's healthcare, nurses, and other healthcare workers working directly with patients, or even, like I said, Starbucks baristas who have really faced a lot of health and safety issues at their stores, a lot of understaffing that's increased their burden at work. So those were our three most common demands: pay, healthcare, health and safety, and staffing. And that's been pretty consistent over the last few years since we started the project in 2021.
Now, Johnny, we saw a lot of organizing, and sadly, though, a lot of that organizing, well, it definitely turned into good news for unions. They voted for the union, but they still didn't get that first contract. And in some instances, weren't there strikes because they did not get that first contract?
Yeah, and we actually, thank you for bringing that up. We had a doubling in sort of the first contract strikes from 2022 to 2023. Because as you mentioned, there's been a lot of high profile and really important organizing campaigns that have not yet resulted in first contracts. Starbucks being the most obvious example because, you know, 400 stores have now voted to unionize. They still haven't negotiated a first contract. However, there has been important, improvements made in that regard. Starbucks has agreed at least to a framework to come to a table and negotiate one contract. Obviously, we'll have to see how that plays out, but it does seem like they're at least finally making the transition from a pretty contentious organizing campaign to maybe actually coming to the table in more of a cooperative matter. We'll see, but I think that's an important development.
We're speaking with Johnny Callis, who's an assistant professor now at the University of Illinois School of Labor and Employment Relations. Johnny, if we can break this down even more, I'm seeing pretty much like 2022, workers in the accommodation and food service industries, they organize the highest number of work stoppages of any industry. Can you break this down for us?
Yeah, this is primarily, you know, not to go back to it again, but Starbucks workers and fast food workers organizing with either the Fight for 15 campaign or now they're called the California Fast Food Workers Union out on the West Coast. So that's primarily what's driving work stoppages and strikes in the accommodation and food services industry are those two campaigns. Over 85% of strikes in that industry come from either of those two campaigns. I think obviously because those workplaces tend to be smaller, when it comes to the number of workers on strike, you see a little bit of a different picture. And in that regard, information, which actually is the industry associated with the Hollywood strikes, healthcare and education and manufacturing are leading the way because those strikes tend to be bigger. This actually is quite a change from 2022. In 2022, 60% of all striking workers came from the educational services industry. Remember, 2022 is when 50,000 University of California grad students and postdocs went out on strike. And it was really driven by that industry. But last year, you saw a lot more strikes in a variety of private sector industries. And I think you're seeing that reflected in our data as well.
So, Johnny, talk to me about how you gather this information. Do you work with the unions to find this out? And also, I guess this is a two-part question here. I mean, I would imagine that you're collecting data already for this year. And what have you seen so far? Can you speak to that?
Yeah, so on the first part, we rely on an excellent team of research assistants right now at Cornell University, but soon to also be from the University of Illinois, who really go out and find these strikes through a variety of different ways, Google News alerts, social media searches. We also have contacts with the labor movement. So the AFL-CIO actually has a strike map similar to ours, but only for their union affiliates, and we actually provide them with some data. And they also provide us with maybe some strikes that perhaps we haven't captured yet, so we have a good ongoing relationship with them. So it comes from a variety of sources, but it's all manually collected. And as you can see, we're not just interested in whether a strike or a protest happens, but, you know, the employer involved, the union involved, the demands involved, the size, duration, location, et cetera. So it does require a lot of manual labor. And I'd say so far in 2024, it's a little bit early to tell, but I think a lot of similar trends are already starting to emerge. You've seen quite a bit of strikes so far in 2024. You haven't seen, at least yet, quite as many large strikes. And I think a big question is, you know, there were a lot of very large contract expirations that came up in 2023. Obviously, with UPS, that didn't lead to a strike, but with the UAW at the Big Three, Kaiser Permanente and SEIU and other healthcare workers. So I'm not sure if you're going to see quite as many workers on strike in 2024 as we saw in 2023, but of course it's impossible to predict, so we'll have to see how it plays out.
Johnny, in the scheme of things, well, first of all, how long has this been going on as far as the research? How many years of data do you have? And I'm just wondering if we're seeing, I know last year was ridiculous, but I'm just wondering how we place right now in the scheme of things with all this work stoppages.
Yeah, so we have comprehensive data only going back to January of 2021, but you can sort of piece together a little bit of picture going back, you know, quite a long ways to the mid-20th century. And what I would say in terms of broad overview is last year was quite a considerable uptick relative to the rest of the 21st century. The last time there were roughly that many workers on strike was 2018, which was also exceptional for the 21st century. That was the year of the statewide Red for Ed teacher and educator strikes. So that was very much confined, not necessarily in a bad way. It was obviously a really important movement, but to a single industry. Last year, you saw a lot more industries and a lot more unions involved. So it's definitely a noticeable uptick compared to the 21st century. However, if you want to go really back far into time, and I think it's important to contextualize these comparisons, the numbers are still quite low if you compare it, for example, to the 1970s when we obviously the unionization rate was much higher, where we're in more of a manufacturing economy. An average year in the 70s saw about 5,000 work stoppages involving approximately 2 million workers a year. Last year, we documented about 470 work stoppages involving 540,000 workers. So it is, believe it or not, relatively low compared to going way back in the 70s, but it's quite high compared to the rest of the 21st century. So that's, you know, it's important to, like I said, contextualize some of those comparisons.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. That was a different time in America, the 1970s.
That's
no
sure.
doubt about that. Johnny, is any of this information posted online at the University of Illinois School of Labor and Employment Relations?
Yeah, you can access our report and you can even access the map itself. So our database is displayed on an interactive map. So obviously if you're interested in the labor movement and or you happen to like maps, it's kind of exciting to see all the activity going on, including, you know, whether you're in Northeast Ohio, whether you're in Central Illinois, wherever you might be, to try and join a picket line. So you can, you know, if you do a quick Google or other search online, Labor Action Tracker, you'll get right to the site, and then you can find more information about our project and links to our annual reports and whatnot on the site itself, and we encourage you to do that if you're able to.
Labor Action Tracker. That's where you got to go to. Labor Action Tracker. Johnny Callis, assistant professor at the University of Illinois School of Labor and Employment Relations. I thank you so much for the insight into what happened last year, and I'm going to let you go back to work and keep track of what's going on this year. Okay, brother?
Will do. Hope to talk to you next year. Thanks so much, Ed. Take it easy.
And that'll be it for another edition of America's Workforce. Coming up tomorrow, the Communication Workers of America and the Smart Transportation Division. Until then, all of you have a safe and wonderful day.
That concludes another episode of the America's Workforce Radio Podcast. Thanks for listening, and be sure to subscribe so you never miss a show. America's Workforce is a production of Labor Tools and BMA Media Group. Find out more information online at labortools.com.